सहना भवतु सहनो भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 नमः श्री शंकरानंद गुरुपादाम्बुजन्मने सविलासमहामोह ग्राहग्रासैककर्मणे
Very good. Welcome back.
We are actually coming towards the end of the text, although we might do something a little special after we conclude the final verse. But these are the closing portions of the fourth chapter, as the white dove, the radiant cup. And in the last class, just to pick up the thread, we've discussed in several prior classes how the locus of the problem is not in Ishvara Srishti, but in Jiva Srishti. We talked about this extensively in past classes. But it's not that all Jiva Srishti means what you create, it's contents of your own mind. But certainly it is not true that all that is Jiva Srishti is undesirable. And that was, remember, our discussion about yoga. So according to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, they want to remove all Jiva Srishti, all mental activity. Since mental activity is a source of suffering, get rid of it. Well, that's like getting rid of the head for the sake of the headache. It works, but a little drastic. But that indeed is the approach of yoga. It's not the only thing yoga teaches, but it is kind of there how the ultimate step is envisioned. Our approach is very different, and that is to recognize Jiva Srishti as a locus of the problem. And then of that Jiva Srishti, that which causes suffering, we get rid of that part. That part which does not cause suffering, in fact, that part which is helpful, we embrace. What part do we get rid of? We said binding, raga, dvesha. Those likes and dislikes whose non-fulfillment causes suffering, that is the part of Jiva Srishti. That is the root, not the absolute root of suffering. Why did I catch myself? Not the root means as fundamental as it gets. Raga dvesha is not the root. What is the root? You can all answer.
Ignorance.
Correct. Good. You're absolutely on board. So ignorance is the root, which is also Jiva Srishti. It's also in the mind. Due to that self non-recognition, failure to recognize your own fullness and completeness. Therefore, raga dvesha. Because raga dveshas are never fulfilled, so this is the part of Jiva Srishti we want to remove. But in the last couple of verses we saw, it divided Jiva Srishti. Here the term used, Jiva Dvaitam, duality. It says it's Dvividha, two kinds of it. One is Shastriya and the other is Akshastriya. Part of it is from the scriptures. The teachings of Vedanta in your mind, Jiva Srishti, that's a good thing. So that's Shastriya Jiva Srishti, which we want to use and employ for the sake of solving the problem, as opposed to a Shastriya Jiva Srishti, which is a problem. And that's our class for today. What is the problems associated with a Shastriya Jiva Srishti? We ended our class last week with this observation that Shastriya Jiva Srishti, the teachings of Vedanta, we want to hold in our minds and employ until the purpose has been fulfilled. Remember, we had a long discussion about that. When you're done using the hammer, you don't carry it around with you for the rest of the day. When you're done with this process of Atma Vichara, self-inquiry, when you're done using these teachings for the sake of removing the problem of suffering, the fundamental problem of ignorance, once that fundamental problem of ignorance has been removed, then there's nothing more to be done. You don't have to hold on to the teachings of Vedanta. Specifically, you don't have to go around all day long reminding yourself, aham brahmasmi, aham brahmasmi, aham brahm. What for? If the ignorance has been removed, the problem is gone. So this is where we ended our last class. So having discussed Shastriya, Jiva Srishti, we now turn to Akshastriya, Jiva Srishti. Before we do, one final comment in the introduction. And it's an observation about the purpose of sannyasa in this tradition. Sannyasa is so often misunderstood based on a literal translation. Sannyasa means renunciation, which is an adequate translation. But in English, the term renunciation immediately conjures up images of running away and avoiding. And it turns out that on analysis, the reason for sannyasa has nothing to do with running away from anything. It has everything to do with running towards. That's what sannyasa is running towards. Sannyasa is running towards what? Shastriya Jiva. And just to illustrate that, many times people have asked me, Swami, how could you? People who know my life in the 70s, in the 80s, I was in California. I had the perfect life for a young techie. And I had it made. I had everything. And then I had a nice little house on the hillside overlooking the ocean and all of this, and at night, all the cool stuff in Santa Barbara, California. And then in end of 86, when I went to begin the 3-year course with Pujya Swamiji, I left it all behind, and that was up. And people will ask Swamiji, how could you give all that up? And many times I've been asked that question, and it's always been so clear to me, I never gave anything. I never in my life had the feeling that I'm giving anything up. If you give something up, then you feel deprived, right? Oh. I never felt that. I only felt a sense of taking the next step towards what I wanted, towards what I wanted most. So sannyasa, properly understood, is not renunciation of the world. And I know that's conventionally how it's envisioned, and I know it ends up involving renunciation of worldly activities, absolutely involves renunciation of worldly activities, but that's not the motivation. The motivation for sannyasa is not to avoid anything. The motivation for sannyasa is to go towards the goal, and here the goal is Shastriya Jiva Srishti. Okay, that being said, now we're ready to return to our text. Having discussed Shastriya Jiva Srishti, the helpful part of the world, now we talk about Ashastriya Jiva Srishti, the not so helpful part. Ashastriyamapi Dvaitam. Akshastriyam, which means Jiva Srishti, which is not concerned with the scriptures, which is concerned with worldly activities. Api is also as Shastriyam Dvaitam, here Dvaitam means Jiva Srishti, is Api also, look at the end of the second line, it is also Dvividha. It is also twofold. So just as Jiva Srishti is twofold, Shastriya and Ashastriya. Now, Ashastriya itself is twofold. See, twofold, then twofold again. So first Jiva Srishti is divided into Shastriya and Ashastriya, and then Ashastriya is further bifurcated, twofold. And what are the two? What are the two varieties? Tivram, intense, and Mandam, not so intense. So two kinds of Ashastriya Jiva Srishti. One kind is Tivra, and the definition of Tivra in this, Tivra means intense. The sense is it causes suffering. Directly it causes suffering. We'll see that in the second half. The second is Manda, which is not intense, kind of gentle or mild, as I'll translate it. Mild sounds like a soap. I don't know. So anyway, Tivra is intense. It can cause suffering. Manda, mild, it causes no suffering. And then he defines the two in more detail in the second half. He says that in the third line, the Tivra variety, the intense variety of Ashastriya Jiva Srishti, is characterized how? Kama, Krodha, Adhikam. It's characterized by Kama, desire, Krodha, anger, Adi, etc. Lobha, Moha, Mada, Vatsarya, etc., etc. All of the undesirable qualities of our mind that cause suffering. Kama, desire, Krodha follows. Interesting that Krodha invariably follows Kama. Why? You have a desire and you can't fulfill it. There's an obstacle to the fulfillment of your desire. And what do you feel in the when fulfilling your desires are obstructed? Krodha. Similarly, lobha, greed, moha, confusion, mada, infatuation, matsarya, jealousy. That's a short list. Some of you are attending the Mahabharata class on Saturday. So we got the medium list on Saturday. We got 12 on Saturday. The long list would go into the hundreds. So these are the negative traits of the mind that cause suffering. Here they're called Tivra, Ashastriya, Jiva, Srishti. That's one word. We put them together into a compound. So the intense variety of Ashastriya, of non-scriptural mental activities. That's as simple to me. So if that's the Tivra, the intense variety that causes suffering, what about the other one, Manda? Manda here is referred to by this pronoun itarata. Itarat means other. The other one, tata, similarly, itarat. The other one, what is the other one? The first one was kama and krodha. The other one, itarat, is manoraja. Some of you know that word. It's being a mental fantasy, imagination. So mental fancies, it's talking about the natural wandering of the mind. The natural wandering of the mind when it's not otherwise engaged in something that's shastriya, in a process of spiritual growth, or if your mind is not caught up in kama and krodha. So basically it's suggesting if your mind is not engaged in sadhana, and if your mind is not caught up in kama and krodha, etc., then whatever is just, my father liked the expression, goofing off. So that's the third variety. Your mind is goofing off, and that's called here manoraja, fantasy, just imagination. It literally means imagination, but that word doesn't have the right sense. I think goofing off has the right sense.
Wandering aimlessly.
Wandering is a kind of the sense, goofing off. Okay. Now, you might think if kama and krodha are tivra, that is intent and capable of causing harm, causing suffering, then Manda, this wandering about, this goofing off of the mind, being Manda, being mild, is harmless. That would be a good conclusion. It would be a wrong conclusion, which is what the next series of verses are going to demonstrate. We're going to talk about how kama and krodha is a problem. Actually, we're going to talk about how to overcome the problem of kama and krodha. We're also going to discuss in the coming verses why even manorajya is a problem, why that wandering of the mind is a problem, why goofing off is a problem, and how to address that. Just to give you the sneak preview, how can a wandering mind be a problem? Well, most of you can figure it out already at the time of meditation. That would certainly be a problem. So that's one of the two major issues we're going to see in the coming verses, that this manorajam is an obstacle to meditation, and we'll see why and how meditation fits into our spiritual life. And then a couple of verses later, he's going to talk about the second problem. I think we'll see this in our next class. The second problem caused by that manorajya, the wandering of the mind. The second problem is wandering leads you into trouble. That is, an innocent thought can lead to a not so innocent thought. And basically, the manda manorajya leads to tivra kama and krodha. Well, it'll be developed in the coming verses. So it's like the stepping stone. They call marijuana a gateway drug. Gateway drug means it's a stepping stone. They acknowledge that marijuana is not that harmful, but as a gateway drug, it leads to more harmful drug use. And there's some truth in that, quite a bit of truth in that. So in the same way, this manorajya is like a gateway problem. In and of itself, it's not that harmful, but it leads to some more severe problems. We'll see that in the coming verses. All right. Ubhayam tatva bodhat pran.
Ubhayam tatva bodhat pran.
Nivaryam bodha siddhaye.
Nivaryam bodha siddhaye.
Shamah samahitatvam cha.
Shamah samahitatvam cha.
Sadhaneshu shrutam yataha.
Sadhaneshu shrutam yataha.
Ubhayam, both of them, nivaryam, are to be avoided. Ubhayam, both of them, both of what? Both kinds of ashastriya, jiva srishti, which means both the tivra part, the intense one, the kama and krodha one, and also the manda one, the not so intense one, mild one, the manorajya, the wandering mind. It says, ubhayam, both of these, nivaryam, are to be avoided. When are they to be avoided? Tattva bodhat prak. Prak, prior to. Prak becomes prang due to some grammar rules. Prak, before tattva bodhat, before gaining enlightenment, these are to be avoided. This is an important point being made here. One is, sorry, I'm spacing out here a little bit. One is, before the dawn of self-knowledge, you are engaged in sadhana, spiritual practice. And this verse is going to talk quite extensively about sadhana, spiritual. Sadhana, we loosely translate as spiritual practice, but its literal meaning is extremely important. Most of you know sadhana as spiritual practice. The literal meaning of sadhana is how you get sadhya. Sadhya is the goal. sadhana then literally is a means to reach the goal. And that's an important thing. Sadhya is the goal. Sadhana is a means, a method to reach the goal. And if in Vedanta the goal is moksha, complete freedom from suffering, and then what is the sadhana to reach that goal? We're going to break it down into a number of parts in this verse, so hold off on that for a moment. But the point here is, why is he saying tattva bodhat prak? Before gaining enlightenment, you better worry about these, you better deal with these, both of these, ubhayam vayam, both the tivra and the manda, you better deal with all these mental problems. Why only tattva bodhat prak? Why only before enlightenment? What about after? Well, you can answer that, right? Yeah, the problem is solved.
Yeah.
So does it mean that after enlightenment you have a perfect mind? How ridiculous would that be? We've discussed in this very class how you can't have a perfect body no matter how long you work out in the gym. In the same way, you can't have a perfect mind no matter how much Vedanta and meditation and other sadhana tapas you do. The mind cannot be perfected any more than the body can be perfected. Then this expression, though, tattva bodhat prak, that these two problems are to be avoided only before enlightenment, meaning the suggestion is, implication is, who cares about after enlightenment? You don't have to worry about them after. You're thinking, wait a minute, how can that be? You don't have to worry about them. The point is, after enlightenment, it becomes extraordinarily clear that what happens in your mind doesn't affect you. This is one of the really big discoveries to be made in spiritual life. And until this discovery is made, all the Vedanta in the world doesn't really change your day-to-day experience. But when you really get it, that you are, the Sanskrit term is asangaha, unconnected, unaffected. When you get it that you are the consciousness that illumines all the mind's activities, just as the sun illumines everything, the sun is not affected by what it shines upon. And you've heard me give the metaphor, if the sun shines on the Bhagavad Gita, it doesn't get more holy. If the sun shines on an open sewer, it doesn't get defiled. In the same way, your consciousness illumines your thoughts, mental activities. When your consciousness illumines sattvika activities, how does that change consciousness? Consciousness reveals the sattvic activities. Consciousness is untouched, unaffected by the sattvic activities, just as the sun is unaffected when it shines on the Bhagavad Gita. Similarly, for rajasa and tamasa activities of your mind, whatever your mind is doing, no matter how lofty or no matter how base, consciousness isn't affected. And you are that consciousness. With this discovery that you are that consciousness which remains utterly unaffected by any and all mental activities, with that discovery, you are free. There's tremendous freedom in that. Which means, suppose there's some kama and krodha in your mind after enlightenment. Is it possible?
Yeah.
We just got done saying the mind won't be perfect. The mind that's not perfect is still a mind that's subject to kama and krodha. So, if the mind is subject to kama and krodha, then you're thinking, wait a minute, then how can you be enlightened? Wait a minute. If the kama and krodha don't affect you, where's the problem? Might be a problem for others, especially krodha. If somebody's around and there's krodha in the mind of an enlightened person, which is possible because the mind is not perfectible, then the other person can be subject to some suffering, but the enlightened one will be unaffected by that krodha. Similarly, when what to speak of manorajya, kama and krodha don't bother you, then what to speak of the mental fancy, they don't mean anything. So, sadhana is the focus prior to enlightenment. After enlightenment, the sadhana comes to an end, which is what we talked about at the end of the last class. Once you're done with the hammer, you put it down. So the hammer is all Shastriya Jiva Srishti, which was necessary before enlightenment, which becomes unnecessary after enlightenment. We talked about that extensively last week, so that's enough. So that's this term here, Tattva Bodha Prak, prior. Prior to enlightenment, Ubhayam, both of these, both the Tivra and Manda, both of them are Nivaryam, are to be avoided. Why? Bodha Siddhaye. Here we're talking about sadhana. Sadhana is a means to the end, sadhya. What is this? Let's just be very precise about our terms. First of all, I'll translate for you. Bodha Siddhaye. Siddhaye, for the purpose of accomplishing. For the purpose of accomplishing what? Bodha, knowledge. And not just any kind of knowledge, Atma Bodha, self-knowledge. Okay, now, the significance here is, and we want to be really precise in our thinking at this point, the goal is moksha. How is moksha gained? And just see if you can recall, we've had these discussions before. We've said, Atma doesn't become liberated. Atma is eternally free, full, complete, divine, perfect. So, we've discussed many times, the problem is not Atma, the problem is, and the term that Pujya Swamiji used again and again, was self-non-recognition. Your true self is full and complete. Your consciousness is already unaffected by what happens in your mind, but you feel like it affects you. It seems to affect you. That's the common experience. And it seems to affect you because, this is Vedanta 101, but it's important enough just to review this. The crystal seems orange. It sure does. In terms of your experience, the crystal seems orange. But the crystal is absolutely clear in spite of the appearance of orangeness. The orangeness is superimposed on the clear crystal, but the crystal remains clear in spite of the superimposition of orangeness. This is our powerful, famous metaphor. In the same way, consciousness, the consciousness which illumines all the activities of your mind, seems to be colored by the activities of your mind. The activities of your mind seem to rub off on Atma, but just as this crystal remains clear in, watch these words very carefully. The crystal remains clear in spite of your experience. True? Do you need to, if you want a clear crystal, do you need to change the experience of orangeness? This is an important discussion, don't you think? If you want a clear crystal, do you need to remove the orangeness? You already have a clear crystal. you need to know that it is a clear crystal. In the same way, this goes back to our discussion of last week and a week before, if you want Satchidananda Atma, which is utterly unaffected by anything in your mind, do you have to remove every last trace of rajas and tamas from your mind that can color Atma? It's not necessary when you know. And that's the term here, bodha-siddhaye. All of this is for the acquisition of bodha knowledge. It's not so important. It's not a change of experience. And I find myself kind of really going after this topic because Pujya Swami Dayananda did many times. Let me give this story a little background. In the 1960s, he was in Rishikesh, back in the time when the young American and European hippies would come to Rishikesh, seeking what? Seeking spiritual experience. Note that word. Back in Europe and the U.S., they had lots of drug experiences. Now they're in India seeking spiritual experience. A handful of them were mature enough to know that experience is not the goal, but the vast majority of them were seeking spiritual experiences. And it turns out that Pujya Swamiji met more than a few of them in Rishikesh seeking experience. And what happened is that really sensitized him to this problem. This is one of the many experiences he had that made him the great teacher he was. And that is, he was extremely aware of the problem of experience seeking. For the vast majority of spiritual seekers, we use that word, what are they seeking? Right? You get this, right? The vast majority of spiritual seekers are seeking spiritual experience. Now you think, what's wrong with that? Well, how long does an experience last? You can have a wonderful and profound spiritual experience and enjoy it and be blissed out, whatever you want to call it. But that experience, like all experiences, comes to an end. And you know very well that there's no such thing as a permanent experience. So therefore, seeking spiritual experience is misguided. And, thank goodness, unnecessary. I would say helpful. Extremely helpful, all the various, in meditation, etc., all the various spiritual experiences you can have, all of that is helpful, sometimes very helpful. So don't let me just kind of put it down. But none of that, even collectively, all of that, all of those spiritual experiences cumulatively are still transient and are still inadequate to set you free. So, finishing this discussion now. It's not necessary to shift your experience of the orange crystal if you know the crystal is clear. And you know the crystal is clear, not just because Swami says it's clear, but because Swamiji explains how the orangeness of the cloth gets reflected in the crystal. So you know the process through which the false image occurs. So this is real wisdom. You don't merely think, oh, the crystal is clear. But you have to answer the question, why do you see orangeness? So when you really get it, you really get it that the crystal remains clear and the orangeness of the cloth merely appears in the crystal, that's knowledge. In the same way, when you really get it, Satchidananda Atma, the consciousness illumining your mind right now, remains utterly unaffected no matter what is going on in your mind. If your mind is filled with krodha, anger, your consciousness remains utterly unaffected. If your mind is filled with sadness, your mind is utterly unaffected. I'm sorry, consciousness is utterly unaffected. If your mind is filled with joy, how can you improve on limitless, boundaryless, full consciousness? It doesn't get improved any more than the sun is improved when it shines on a holy book. Okay, so you get it. It's a matter of knowledge, not experience. It's a matter of knowledge. Shankara says in several places, jnanameva mokshaha. Moksha, liberation, is jnanam, knowledge. Eva here means alone. Jnanameva moksha. Now at this point, somebody will say, hey, that sounds very, what is the term they use? Like the fundamentalists say, only through Jesus Christ. Only through Jesus Christ can you be saved. That's the language of the fundamentalists. So here is Shankara saying, only through knowledge can you gain moksha. So is Shankara in the same boat as our Christian fundamentalist friends? Well, here, we just rely on our very simple understanding. Tell me, if the problem is ignorance, not if, the problem is ignorance, right? If you want a clear crystal, it means, what is the problem? Ignorance. You already have a clear crystal. Mm-hmm. If you want a clear crystal, the problem is ignorance. If you want moksha, the problem is ignorance. And since the problem is ignorance, can you pick and choose the solution? Look at that. So we gave the example of tools in a prior class. If the nail is sticking out, screwdriver isn't going to do you much good. If there's a loose screw, the hammer isn't going to do you much good. If the problem is ignorance, the solution is knowledge. That's not fundamentalism, it's just common sense. So when Shankara says knowledge alone liberates you, he's not being a fundamentalist. But please note, he doesn't dismiss the importance of bhakti and karma yoga and jnana and all of this. He's not saying you throw everything away. He's just saying knowledge liberates. With the help of all the other things, in fact, that's our topic. I'm kind of working my way into it a little slowly. We'll get there. So, knowledge liberates. How do we get that knowledge?
Scripture.
Scripture is a correct answer. Mm-hmm. But why? In order to gain knowledge, we have to have this. There's some real fundamentals that we haven't discussed adequately in this class. So this is a nice opportunity to really pick up these fundamentals. So, correct. The scripture is a source of knowledge. But how does that work? How do you gain knowledge? This is an important subject both in Vedanta and in every philosophical system. The ancient Greeks called it epistemology. Epistemology is the study of how we gain knowledge. And if, you know, since we've identified that the problem is ignorance, since we've identified that the solution is knowledge, we should know something about how we can get that knowledge. That's the study of epistemology, and we won't go into a lot of depth, but just very briefly, let's look at it. In order to gain knowledge of me sitting here, if seeing me is the sadhya, Dhyā means goal. That which is to, literally, that which is to be gained, that which is to be accomplished. Is what the word sadhya means. If the sadhya is perceiving me sitting here, what is the sadhana? The means. The means is the power of sight. So your power of sight is a means for seeing me. And here, if we're talking about a means for gaining knowledge of my presence in the chair, we say then that your eyes are a means of knowledge for seeing form. Means of knowledge is a translation of a very important... Let me show you two pairs of words. So far I've been using this pair. Sadhya, which is that which is to be obtained, and sadhana, the means. Sadhya, that which is to be obtained, and sadhya, the means for attaining. Now suppose we narrow our discussion a little bit. These are very broad terms. We narrow our discussion a little bit to when the sadhya is knowledge. Suppose the sadhya is knowledge, and we can use, I'm going to actually shift a little bit. Pramaya is actually the parallel word, but I'm going to use instead prama. Prama means knowledge. Now, and pramaya, like I said, pramaya is the logical one here, but prama is kind of easier for us to handle. So prama means knowledge. That to see me standing here, that perception of me is a kind of prama, it's a kind of knowledge. For the sake of gaining prama, knowledge, you need a proper means of knowledge. Which means, proper means, not just any means. Your ears are also a means of knowledge. Okay? But will your ears tell you about me standing here? Scripture is also a means of knowledge. Will scripture tell you about me standing here? Inference is also a means of knowledge. Inference isn't going to tell you. So you need an appropriate means of knowledge, and the word we use for that is pramana. Pramana means an appropriate means of knowledge. The pramana for form is your sight, eyes. The pramana for sound is your ears, etc., etc. The pramana for knowing the fire on the mountain when you can only see smoke. The pramana for knowing that there is fire on the mountain when you can only see smoke is inference. Inference is also a means of knowledge. And the pramana for knowing your true nature as Satchidananda Atma is scripture. So you get the sense. So depending on the nature of what it is to be known, I'll put the word up here. Here, any, because that's really the right word. The word is prameya, is a parallel word here. Prameya literally means that which is to be known. So prameya, that which is to be known, your true nature, your true self, and you better have the right pramana, the right means of knowledge. So what is the pramana for knowing your true nature, Satchidananda Atma? Well, sight and hearing, taste, touch, and smell are not going to be of much help because Atma can't be seen, heard, tasted, smelled, or touched. So not much help. How about inference? Can we infer the existence of Atma? And this is a little tricky. Inference, notice if you want to gain knowledge of the fire on the mountain, you begin by perceiving smoke. And it turns out all forms of inference begin with perception. And since all forms of inference begin with perception, if Atma is imperceptible, Atma can't be inferred. So inference turns out not to be a valid pramana for knowing Atma. Well, that pretty much narrows it down. So the one pramana we have, means of knowledge for understanding your true nature as consciousness utterly affected by thoughts, etc. The means is shastra, scripture. This is a huge topic. We could spend hours and hours. We're just giving you the outline, just enough to understand an important topic that's hidden in this verse, which I want to bring up. Now, here's the next thing. In order for a pramana to operate, several conditions must be met. For example, your eyes are a pramana, but suppose you're looking someplace else. So that would be a problem. So the eyes have to be properly used. Suppose you need glasses and you forgot your glasses. That's another example of an impediment which is going to prevent that pramana from giving proper knowledge. So, for a pramana to operate, there must be certain conditions met. For the pramana, which is scripture, for that pramana to operate properly, there are two
flat tire.
Oh, that's too bad. Okay,
that explains, huh? It was an odd sound to hear that. So for the pramana, which is scripture, to operate, there are two primary conditions that have to be met. One is the pramana is scripture, but it's, you open up a book, is that book going to teach you? So there's, in order for that pramana to operate, it has to be wielded by someone, and not just anyone. So you open up your, you go home and you open up your what are we studying here? Panchadashi. Suppose you have your child start reading the translation. You have a child reads the translation and you're listening. I'm not sure that's going to be very effective. In order for a scripture to work properly, the two conditions, one of the two conditions is it has to be wielded by an appropriate teacher. And in the Upanishad it says Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam, the two qualifications. Some of you are familiar with that language. The teacher has to be deeply rooted in the scriptural tradition, that is, a scholar of the scriptures, but not merely a scholar of the scriptures. The teacher also needs to be Brahmanishtam, established in the truth revealed by the scripture. So the two factors for scripture as a pramana to yield knowledge, to create knowledge in your mind. Criteria one is it must be used, wielded by a proper guru, proper teacher, one who is skilled in a scriptural tradition, shrotriya, and one who is established in that knowledge, brahmanishtam. That's 50%. What is the other 50%? That's right. So teacher is half of the formula. You're the other half of the formula. So if the teacher has to be properly qualified, Shrotriya and Brahmanishta, I suppose the student also has to be properly qualified. And the simple metaphor to illustrate this, I've made up the story long ago, I've used it so often. Suppose you're in college, and back in your college days, you go and attend a class on calculus. And you attend every class, you take copious notes the whole semester, and when you write the final exam, you score zero. Now, how to explain that? So put the professor was highly skillful. And you made tremendous effort. You didn't miss any classes, took all these notes. So what was the problem? The problem is you haven't studied trigonometry, you haven't studied algebra, you're still having trouble with long division. Which means, remember back in your college days, we talked about prerequisites. If you do not possess the prerequisites for that course, you're not likely to be successful in your study. There are certain prerequisites for that calculus course. There are certain prerequisites in using any pramana. For many of us, prerequisite for seeing is glasses. That's a prerequisite to see clearly, is you have to have glasses. These are the conditions. So here, let us talk about the prerequisites on the student side. The prerequisite on the teacher's side, Shrotriyam Brahmanishnam. Skillful in the teaching tradition, established in this knowledge. What are the prerequisites on the student side? This verse in the second half talks about it, so let me put it up here. First of all, one who possesses these prerequisites is a qualified student whom we call adhikari. Adhikari means qualified student. Please don't use this as a Hindi word. We're not talking about we're not talking about somebody like a government official or something like that. So in Vedantic terminology, adhikari means qualified student and has no other meaning. So whenever the word adhikari is used in Vedanta, it means a qualified student. What are the prerequisites that make you an adhikari, a qualified student? This is really a very fundamental topic, but it's so important, and some of you may not have heard this, or some of you may have forgotten this, so let's just take a few minutes and refresh our minds. What are the conditions or qualifications? How many are the qualifications? You've already guessed. There are four main qualifications that make you an adhikari. One is viveka. Viveka means the ability to discriminate, to discern. For example, the ability to discriminate between clay and pot. And not just clay and pot, but that means the ability to discern between Brahman, between Satyam and Mithya, eventually. So to be capable of discernment with regard to spiritual topics is viveka. Next comes vairagya. Good. Any of you know this? Vairagya. Doesn't look like vairagya. Vairagya means dispassion. Dispassion means as long as you think you can find contentment out of there in the world through your worldly activities, to that extent you're not going to be very engaged in the teachings of Vedanta. So conversely, to the extent that you've recognized that all worldly activities cannot make you perfectly content, cannot bring perfect peace, this understanding is called vairagya. We're going to see it in the second half. And the third of the qualifications is a group of six. A group of six mental attributes that gives you a certain inner maturity. The six mental attributes that give you inner maturity are called Shama. Shama means quietude. Dhamma means self-control. Shama, control of your mind. Dhamma, control of your body, including your tongue.
which includes speech. Next is uparati, several ways of translating it, most often withdrawal from worldly activities. And if you think withdrawal from worldly activities doesn't have to mean sannyasa, although sometimes this is actually translated sannyasa. Right now, are you engaged in any worldly activities? This is a spiritual activity. So at least for this hour and a half, you are all withdrawn from worldly activities. This is uparati. Then comes titiksha. Titiksha, forbearance. Forbearance in the sense that you're able to not be distracted by worldly problems. Too hot, too cold, who cares? Vedanta is more important. It's kind of the mental attitude. Titiksha. And the last two, we've got one, two, three, four. Then, Shraddha. Shraddha. Not exactly faith, at least not in the sense of blind faith. Faith, here Shraddha means really trust. Nice translation. They say, Guru Shastreshu Vishwasaha. Trust in the teacher and the scripture. Not blind faith. Blind faith is not, I could talk for an hour on why blind faith is an obstacle to spiritual growth. Honestly, blind faith is an obstacle to spiritual growth. Shraddha is not blind faith. It's trust or confidence that the guru and the shastra comprise the valid means of knowledge. And the final one is samadhanam. Samadhana is actually a synonym for samadhi. Samadhana is a synonym for samadhi, meditative absorption. And what do these six comprise are qualifications. If you want to be a prepared student, assuming you have access to the scripture, access to a qualified teacher, in order for that pramana to operate and be fruitful in giving you knowledge, you must be an adhikari, a prepared student. And what are those requirements? You have to be capable of this discernment. You have to have sufficient dispassion towards the world. You have to have all six of these traits, which comprise a kind of spiritual maturity. And the last of the four is mumukshutva. A desire for liberation. If any of these four are missing, or with regard to that group of six, if any of those six are missing, you are an unadhikari. And an unadhikari is the example I gave in the calculus class, which means no matter how hard you try, and no matter how good the teacher is, no matter how good the book is, no matter how diligent you are in your studies, if you are unprepared, if you don't have the prerequisites, if you are an unadhikari, it doesn't yield the proper results. So, this we needed to go through this, these basics, because that's what this verse is talking about. And that is handling this jiva srishti, handling the ashastriya jiva srishti is necessary. He says, bodha siddhaye, for the sake of gaining knowledge. For the sake of gaining knowledge means for the sake of adhikaritva, for the sake of being an adhikari. That's our context. You must be an adhikari, and that's what he talks about in the second half. All of this was to get us ready for the second half. And he says, and why is it
that ubhayam, both of these, both what? Both the tivra problem of kama and krodha and the manda problem of manoraja, mental fancies, ubhayam, both of these nivaryam, must be avoided bodha siddhaye, for the sake of gaining knowledge. Why? And before we answer the question why, please notice that this being an adhikari is a little different here than it is in that calculus classroom. In that calculus classroom, you better know trigonometry and algebra and all of that stuff before, because it's all used there. But how about if you have this problem of kama and krodha, will that prevent you from learning calculus? No. But he's saying here that kama and krodha will make you an unadhikari for Vedanta, which means this is unusual stuff we're studying. This isn't an ordinary subject matter like calculus. Calculus is an ordinary subject matter. Ordinary in that sense, in worldly knowledge. This is a very different kind of subject matter. In fact, we could say subject matters are twofold. One is all of that. The other is you. One subject matter is you. That's the unique subject matter. The other subject matter is everything. And whenever I use that expression, I have such a fond memory of my guru, who back in the 1970s had a fairly strong Tamilian accent. And the first time I heard him, he said distinctly, everything else, and I had no idea what he was talking about. I wasn't used to Indian accents at first. Actually, I met him in 1981. So in 1981, I heard everything else, and I and he used that expression often because this is the fundamental distinction. There are two kinds of subject matter. One subject matter is you. The other subject matter is everything else. So when the subject matter is you, we have these very special prerequisites. Why? Because the subject matter is special. If the subject matter is special, then the prerequisites are special. Unlike calculus, calculus is an algebra and trig, where it's something very special. So ubhayam, both of these problems are nivaryam, to be avoided, bodha siddhaye, for the sake of knowledge, for the sake of using the pramana successfully. For the sake of using pramana successfully, what were the two major factors? One major factor was qualified teacher. Second major factor is qualified student. And he's talking about now in the second half the qualified student. He says, why are these two important? Why is removing the tivra and manda important? Last line, yataha, because. Shutam, it has been said, we have heard what? Sadhaneshu, that amongst the various means for gaining knowledge, sadhana is, well, we use that term up here, the means for knowledge. In a manner of speaking, all of these can be considered means of knowledge, loosely speaking. In that, without them, you don't get knowledge. With them, you can gain knowledge. So the verse loosely refers to these as sadhana, as means for gaining your goal. And what does he identify? He picks up two out of our list. Two things that are required for the sake of bodha siddhaye, for the sake of knowledge. He gives two here. What does he give two? He says one is shama. Shamaha, and the other is samadhittvam. Here is shama, and these are all synonyms.
samahita is being in samadhi. So samadhana is a synonym for samadhi. Samahita means to be absorbed in samadhi. So they're all related words. So he's picked just two of these, but clearly the implication is that they're all required. You can't just pick and choose. Can you say, for the calculus class, can you have trig and no algebra? Or algebra and no trig? Whatever is a prerequisite, you need them all. You don't get to pick and choose. In the same way, here we need all of these, and just to summarize this before we go on, what is he saying in this verse? These problems of like kama and krodha, these problems like a wandering mind, are obstacles. Obstacles to enlightenment. How are they obstacles to enlightenment? Because they deprive you of being a qualified student. If you don't have shama, you are not a qualified student. If you don't have samahitatva, samadhi, ability to meditate, you are not a qualified student. If you do have kama and krodha, you're not a qualified student. Why? If you do have kama, what about this vairagya? So the presence of kama means the absence of vairagya. If you do have krodha, then by definition you don't have sama. And if you do have manoraja, wandering mind, you certainly don't have samadhana. Final comment on this verse. Why did he pick just these two out of this entire list? He's just picked these two. Well, he's talking about the tivra and the manda. So the tivra, like kama and krodha, and are obstacles for shama. And the other one is the manda, the manoraja. Manoraja is an obstacle for samadhi. So he chose those two in particular because shama is the opposite of kama and krodha. And samahitatva is the opposite of smanoraja. Okay, we've spent a long time on this verse. Let's see the next one. We may or may not see the whole thing. Let's look at it.
Kamyadi dosha drishtyadyaha. Kamyadi dosha drishtyadyaha. Kamaditya hetavaha.
Kamaditya hetavaha.
Prasiddha moksha shastreshu.
Prasiddha moksha shastreshu.
Tanan vishya sukhi bhava.
Tanan vishya sukhi bhava.
There is some really important discussion to be made with this verse. And if we just started, it's not going to be very useful, to be very fruitful. So I think what we'll do is we'll stop here for this evening. What we are going to see in that verse when we meet next time is he's going to talk about how to remove the tivra problem, how to remove the kama and krodha. This verse is about how to remove the kama and krodha, and the next couple of verses are about how to remove the manoraja. So all of this is required for the sake of being an adhikari. If you're not an adhikari, then we have a few minutes. One final point here, and this is important. Because there's an inappropriate connection in when we use the term prerequisite in the sense of college students. in general, it's a good metaphor, but there's one defect. Excuse me, just a moment. This is important, and we do have a few minutes here at the end of class. I'm glad I remember this. It's quite important to share this. One thing we know about university education is it's highly structured, very linear. Linear. Study this, then you study this, and you study. Remember, you had the 100 level classes, the 200, the 400, etc., etc. So very stepwise, very linear. Turns out this is not linear at all. Again, the subject matter is so different. The subject matter is you, not everything else. So since the subject matter is you, the whole process is going to be different than any other kind of external subject matter. And one of the consequences of it is the process of gaining this knowledge is exceedingly non-linear. And let me explain what I mean by that term. Linear means get adhikari tvam first. So if you want to learn calculus, what it's step one, learn algebra. Step one, learn long division. Step two, algebra. Step three, trigonometry. Then you're ready for calculus. Okay, step. So if you want to gain atmajnanam, what is step one? Adhikaripa. What is step two? Find a qualified teacher and scripture. Step three is what we're doing now. Okay, this would be very linear. But if we take it in a very linear way, that only an adhikari should come to class, you've got a problem. I mean, look at these requirements. They're pretty lofty requirements. So if there were a rule that only a qualified student should attend a Vedanta class, Vedanta classes would be empty. So this observation is about the non-linear way in which we learn in Vedanta. Specifically, turns out that these four qualities are cultivated more than any other time. They're cultivated in class. The act of attending the class is cultivating adhikaritvam. Now, it's a little bit ironic because the purpose of the class is to gain atmajnanam, but atmajnanam won't take place until you're an adhikari. So, but you go on attending the classes and your adhikaritvam grows and grows and grows. Finally, it becomes sufficient. And then, the teachings which you've already been listening to, the teachings click. You've already heard. I've made the comment before. You've already heard more Vedanta than you need to know. Honestly, for the sake of moksha, you've already heard more than necessary. So if moksha is still pending, what is the problem? Lack of adhikaritvam.
Lack of homework.
No, not homework. Adhikaritvam. And let me conclude. There's just a fabulous metaphor to describe this, where the unadhikari, the unqualified student, is compared to a bunch of wet twigs. Suppose you have a pile of wet twigs and you want to make a fire. You have all the wet twigs. And you want a fire? What do? You light a match. That match, the light of wisdom, is a metaphor. All right? That match represents the light of wisdom, which means what goes on in a class, that which is coming from a qualified student and scripture, is represented by the match. So that's half the formula, is the burning match represents the teacher. By the way, that's what this color symbolizes, right? Really, it's the color of fire for that very reason. So, The burning match represents the guru and shastra, and the wet twigs represent those sitting in your chairs. And what happens? So you take that burning match and hold it to the twigs, and what happens? Nothing. The match goes out, twigs don't catch fire. Then what do you do? Light another match. Hold it to the twigs. What happens? Nothing. Third match, fourth match, 20 matches, 50 matches. But what's happening is each match dries out the wood a little bit. And the wood becomes increasingly dry through these 50 matches. Eventually, when the twigs are sufficiently dry, it catches. Now, it's interesting. You say, you know, what you want is, it was on the 119th match that the twigs, so you're thinking, you know, on such and such a class, I gained that missing knowledge, that 119th class. In the hundreds, I'm making a counterexample. Watch this a little carefully. In the 119th class, you find yourself enlightened, and you think, hey, I heard something tonight I've never heard before, which is a wrong conclusion. You've heard it all before. You've heard plenty of Vedanta. It's not that you need to hear something that you haven't already heard. And by the way, this was a big issue for me for years. I'm still waiting for that missing link or something like that. Took me a long time to figure out. There's no missing bits. There's no missing link. What happens is when you are sufficiently prepared, when you gain sufficient adhikari from, you already have plenty of Vedanta with you, it clicks. Just as that 119th match causes the twigs which are sufficiently dry, they ignite in the same way. The day will come when you are sufficiently prepared and everything that you've been listening to just clicks, as it were. It's a nice American expression. I don't have a better word for that. It clicks. You get it. And it's really that. It's that. Okay, we'll end.
Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashyap Dukha Bhavet, Asato Ma Satgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityurma Amritam Ramaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Before you go, let me just mention this coming Sunday we have our monthly advanced meditation session. Some of you may be interested in that. Sunday at 6:15. Sunday at 6:15 at 6:15. Good night. See you soon.